Going without. It was the season of Lent. She mused on the thought of going without. She knew what deficiency was all about. Not her own planning and against her own will, her riches and much registered right close to nil. Shortages and deficiencies, that was her life. Short on wisdom, slow with words, lack of patience, unmotivated, a serious deficit of peace and of joy. How easily she switched from calm to annoy. That she was poor, there was no doubt. Yet when she considered it, she still owned a lot. Stuff, the weight of which pulled her down. How she acquired this, she can't recall. This heaviness often has caused her to fall. She stopped to look at all that's behind. Nothing of worth at all she could find. In fact, as far as her good eye can see, it's just broken things that weighs like steel on her mind. She can't let it go. She's always carried it wherever she goes, while eating and sleeping, and God only knows where all she's dragged this around. Still nothing of worth she has found. Going without while having much stuff. From her gloomy musings, she turned to go when her eye caught a speck of red in the mud. Her sore back bent down low. It was a red ribbon she smoothed with her hands and, as though precious, rubbed at the dirt and gritty sand. A moment of clarity came to her soul. 'Twas only a moment, but she had a new goal. She recalled her old circle skirt, so colorful and long. She had worn it to dances when she still had a song. The color long faded, it mattered not now. She gathered her stuff that so long dragged her down, stuffed it into that skirt with that ribbon tied round. With new purpose, she moved forward, still dragging her load. This new path now was rocky, uncomfortably steep. She tried swinging the bundle up on her back. That failed, so she dragged that circle skirt sack. With tears flowing freely, she climbed the steep hill, clutching at shrub branches, thorns cutting her hands. Determined, she moved forward through dust and dry sand, not feeling the cuts, not aware of her tears. She set her mind to ignore her strong, growing fears. She felt a hand then, reaching down from above, grabbing hers tightly, such strength and such love, still clutching her load as she collapsed at his feet. She saw that old cross and wondered that here they should meet. She was genuinely glad for his help, climbing that steep, thorny hill, but for some reason his presence here did not give her a thrill. She felt his compassion. It was honest and true. He knew all things about her and what she'd been through. To be quite honest, she was tired of carrying her load. But that is all she had. Must she let go of that too? She looked full in his kind, loving eyes and slowly loosened her grasp and gave it all to him. With a sigh of relief, she now understood that going without was meant to be good. Her sorrows and failures, he carried them now. Even her tears, he stored away like a treasure that would be useful someday. She, light of foot, while he carried that load, down that path, walked together until they reached home.
At least there aren't any angry crowds around today. I want to thank you for inviting me to come and share my story with you. And I'm not here to defend myself or argue in my favor. But I'd just like you to be able to hear another side of the story. I find it rather interesting when you look in the Bible, the two men who arguably had the greatest influence on Jesus' life, Joseph, the father, and me, Judas Iscariot, virtually nothing has been written about us. It's left to your imagination to decide who we were and what we were all about. But before I continue with my story, I want to just ask you a question. Since I've already whispered my name, Judas Iscariot, I can see how you're reacting to my name. You know who I am. But think about it. What if someone would come to you and look at perhaps the worst decision you've ever made in your life, or the worst action you've ever taken in your life, and said, "That's how I'm going to remember you. None of the rest of it matters. I'm going to remember you for your darkest moment in your history." And that's what they're going to think about you. Nothing else matters. Well, actually, that's my life. That's my story. You only know me as Judas, the man who betrayed Jesus, the Son of God. That's all you know about me. And quite honestly, I doubt you really are interested in much more about me, because that says everything you need to know. Well, I think there's a bit more to me. I'd like to be able to share that story with you if you could give me that opportunity. That moment is a moment I would like to forget for the rest of my life. But there was another side to me. I was born Judas Iscariot. And as people are prone to do when someone does something terrible, we will tend to go back and try to look at all the events that happened before that and say, "Oh yeah, all these things pointed to the fact that he was going to be the person he said he was going to be, or what he's going to do." And so the same thing has happened with me. I was born Judas Iscariot. But what's the first thing they do is they say, "Oh, Iscariot, ah yeah, that's a little bastardization of the word Sicarii," which is, they were a group within the group of the Zealots. They carried daggers to commit assassins, and they would kill the Jewish leaders who they felt weren't doing enough to bring about the overthrow of the Roman government. And so it's so easy, Iscariot, Sicarii, he must have been destined for evil right from his birth. But then they overlooked the other parts of my name. Judas, which is a Greek version of a very common name back then, Judah. And in Hebrew, Judah means God be praised. God be praised. Oh yeah, that really fits together well with God be praised and he is an assassin. Mm-hmm. But people like to connect dots, right? Well, here's the other side of me. I am Judas Iscariot. But in Hebrew, Iscariot is Iscarioth, or man from Kerioth. And in Judea, there was a region named Kerioth. And there were two towns, actually, in Judean region that were called Kerioth. And so, if you look at my name, I am Judas Iscariot. I was the son of Simon Iscariot, or the son of Simon from Kerioth. That's who I was. And that's who I am. Well, I was born and raised in a very typical peasant-style Jewish family. We were never wanting, but we never had any extra. We had barely enough for a family, but it was a good family home. The Jewish culture at the time said all young males had to be educated so that they could learn about the Book of Moses and the prophets. And so I had received my education like that as well. I knew about the Book of Moses, and I was very familiar with the prophets. And I knew that in the prophets they talked about this Messiah that was supposed to come sometime and set his people free. I was familiar with that. I knew that. And like normal children growing up in a household, even when things aren't necessarily said, you gain understandings via osmosis. It just filters into you. And even though my parents were not political, you felt vibrations. You heard the whispers. You overheard the conversations between friends and neighbors. And I knew that my parents longed for the day when the Romans would no longer be a part of our lives. And I knew that they longed for this Messiah that they understood to be coming. And so by the time I was a young man, I had absorbed that into my thinking. And I too was one of those people who longed for this Messiah because I resented this Roman occupation. We were a people and we ought to have our own king and our own kingdom. We ought to be able to live according to our rules and regulations and not the Roman rule and regulations. And some people have said, well, he was a zealot, which is the gentler version of the Sicarii. Well, I think quite honestly I would say I was a sympathizer because I certainly longed for the overthrow of the Roman government. But I was not at the point where I was going to physically go ahead and do that, bring about that kind of a battle. But I did sympathize. And so as a young man, when I was in school, I was good at math. I was good at numbers. I liked it. And I was told that I was actually quite an ambitious fellow. And I longed for the day. I didn't have any major goals, if you would call it that, some major dream. But I had a dream. I had a dream that I would be able to earn a living that was better than the ones my parents had had, so that maybe I could just enhance my quality of life a little bit. And I was looking for a way of getting a job that maybe would move me up the social ladder a little bit from being part of the peasant family. Who knows? But that was my goal. Young man, I'm at home, and I start hearing stories about this character named Jesus, claiming to be the Messiah, doing some miraculous things. And I'm like, initially it's like, yeah, right. He and along with a whole lot of others who claimed to be the Messiah, and after a little while it blew away and they were gone. And I'm sure there's more Messiahs to come. And so I didn't pay much attention initially. But you know, these rumors kept persisting. And I'm thinking to myself, I should check this out. Maybe there's some possible truth to this scenario. And besides, I am waiting for this Messiah to come and set my people free. And so I went on Google. No, I didn't. So I went and searched out. And I found out where Jesus was hanging out, where he was teaching and healing. And so I walked over there. And of course, you don't walk up to a man. You don't walk up to him and ask him all kinds of questions. So I did what most crowds were doing. We were following Jesus. I was following him around. I was hanging around the fringes, listening to what he had to say, watching him, observing him, trying to find out, is this the man that I was possibly waiting and looking for? And you know what? That man, Jesus, he impressed me. He impressed me a lot. I mean, think about it. He was going about, first of all, he's going about healing and curing people's all kinds of illnesses and ailments. And that's amazing. He was telling stories. He was an incredible orator. He could hold the people in the palm of his hand with the parables he was telling. It was amazing. And the other thing that amazed me is he wasn't just speaking like a Pharisee or a scribe, a fellow teacher. When he spoke, the authority with which I'd never heard that before. He spoke with an authority that all the other people, not just me, we caught that. And I'm thinking to myself, as I listen to his message, this man has a potential to be the leader of this revolution, of this overthrow of the Roman government. This sounds like he is the potential savior of my people, of me. Oh, and I listened to his messages. I listened a lot. I heard him talk about the Beatitudes. Yeah. And as I heard him talk about being a poor in spirit, about being meek, about thirsting and hungering for righteousness. And then he talked about, blessed are those who are persecuted. I'm like, he's describing my people. He's talking right toward us. And you know the other thing that amazed me about Jesus? Speaking with authority, yes. But he was fearless. He spoke his mind. He spoke what he believed to be right. It didn't matter whether you were a Roman centurion, whether you were Caesar, whether you were one of the Pharisees. He simply said it the way he believed. He challenged any and all authority if he felt it needed to be challenged. And I observed that. And I kept that in the back of my mind. Because you need to do those things if you're going to be leading a revolution. But the biggest thing for me was the magnetism, the charisma that he carried. People were drawn to him. They wanted to follow him. I was one of those who was impressed and I wanted to follow. And you know, it wasn't long. Jesus was continuing, going on, doing his teaching and preaching and healing. And over time, he decided he needed an inner circle. He needed a group of 12 to help him out in his ministry. And so as he's walking along, he sees Peter and Andrew and he calls them. And later on, he finds James and John doing their fishing. He calls them. And guess what? On one of those days, he called me, Judas. He called me to be part of his inner circle. I was flabbergasted at first. I mean, me? He picked me? On the other hand, I was incredibly impressed. And you'll notice a little later on, he must have seen something good in me because he even made me treasurer of our little group, of our little band. He must have seen something good in me. But what I want you to remember is you know me as the betrayer. But notice that shortly after he got the 12 of us together, he did something that most people don't remember about me or any of the rest of us 11. Sorry. Jesus gathered us together. And then he said, spoke to us, he taught us, and then he gave us the power and the authority to cast out demons, to raise people from the dead, to cure the sick and the lame, and to proclaim the good news to everybody that we came in contact with. It wasn't just Jesus doing that. He gave all of us 12 disciples. And notice it says he called the 12 and gave them this power. It wasn't he called the 12 except Judas. It wasn't he called the 11. He called me too. Me. The one who betrayed him was also given that power and authority, and I exercised that power and authority together with the other 11 disciples. Together with Jesus. I was part of the ministry team. And I managed to stay and hang around him. And I kept on hearing and listening to what he was saying. But you'll also notice that at one point, we disciples were doing some healing and this one man came to us to be healed and we couldn't heal him. And so the guy turns to Jesus, who was not that far from us, and he turns to him and asks him to be healed, and Jesus heals him. And we're like, what just happened here, Jesus? You gave us the power and the authority to heal, and we couldn't heal him. And you did. And he says, oh, ye of little faith. It wasn't exactly his words, but that was the point. We still didn't have enough. We still didn't get Jesus, really. Well, anyway, I kept following him. I kept doing the ministry with Jesus, and I was impressed. And one time after he'd been feeding a crowd, there was about 200 people or so that came running to Jesus, and they wanted to crown him king. And I'm like, yes, this is the next step in the evolution, right? Or the revolution, I should say. We're moving on. The next is to choose the leader, to make it formal, and then to move forward so we can set our people free. And I was excited about that. But what did Jesus do? He turned, and he walked away. Well, that night, I went home, and I was, well, I was really shook up and I was disappointed. This was a very nice, subtle step we could have taken in this role toward the revolution being put into full motion. And Jesus had turned away, but as I tried to figure this out, I said to myself, he's charismatic, he's an incredible orator, a storyteller. He has a tremendous amount of compassion. He has guts like no one I've ever seen before. He wishes to challenge the authority, and he does it quite calmly and fearlessly. But he's also politically savvy. I mean, think about this. First group of 200 people come running up to you and want to make you king, and you accept it. Like, who are you king of? 200 people, maybe. But I'm thinking, Jesus had this figured out. No, you got to play a little bit of hard to get. You don't sign up with the first 200. You're waiting till the tens of thousands come to you and want to make you king. So then it makes sense that he turned and ran away. He wasn't ready yet for just the mere crowd. He wanted the whole country to be in his favor and wanting him to be king, because that's when the revolution could take off. Well, that was the first time where that niggling little feeling came in. You see, by now I'd put Jesus in this box. He was the man, the Son of God, the one who was called to be the Messiah. He was coming to set his people, us, free. I had the vision of this Jesus as the here and now Savior. Not the world view, not the world Savior. I had him pegged as that man. And everything he did had to fit into that box. But this incident, not taking on the kingship, I don't know what to do with that. I put it in my pocket. I didn't throw it away, but I put it in my pocket because it didn't fit the box. But after that transfiguration on the mount, a lot of things changed in Jesus' message. And I heard something that started making me very uncomfortable because it didn't fit into my box. He started talking about when he was going to die, when he was going to be betrayed, when he was no longer going to be here. And think about it, folks. You're going to start a revolution and set your people free, and then the very leader who's going to lead you is going to be gone. What happens to a revolution? It dies. It dies a premature death. Very seldom does a second leader step in and fill that void. And how Jesus is talking about leaving just when we're gaining momentum? It doesn't fit my picture. I don't get it. But in the meantime, I'm walking along with him in the ministry and watching him. And then one day he's invited, and he raises Lazarus from the dead. That was a really monumental time in the shift, I think, when I think back of it. Because up to that point, I mean, he had really been a thorn in the side of the Pharisees already. They wanted to get rid of him. They just didn't know how. But when he raised Lazarus from the dead, they really would have liked to see Lazarus and Jesus disappear. But what amazed me, and again, I didn't understand, is he turned around a few days later and he went back into that home. Jesus knew, we knew, the Pharisees were looking for a way of getting rid of him. And without any fear or concern for his own life, he went back and he kept on doing what he had done. He healed the sick. He made the lame walk again. He restored sight to the blind. His compassion continued to pour out. And he still kept talking about doing kingdom work in a different way. So I'm confused. Because he's talking about dying and leaving, but I'd heard him say that I have come not to abolish the law, but that the law and the prophets would be fulfilled. Okay. And I also heard Jesus say, I heard it clear, I was there standing right beside him when he said, "You think I have come to you in peace? I have not come to you in peace. I have come with a sword." son will rise up against father and daughter against mother and daughter-in-law, and you know the story. I mean, how does that fit in? That fit in with Jesus, the revolutionary, the one who is going to come and set his people free. But how does this, I'm not going to be here, fit into that picture? I don't know. And I could go on for a long time, I won't. So anyway, we come to the time getting ready for the Passover. And we gather together to have a meal together. We're having a good time. Good time, considering what we're celebrating. Anyway, in that celebration, Jesus all of a sudden says to us as we're getting ready to have the meal together, he says, one of you is going to betray me. And I think you will remember what the disciples did. I mean, each one of us, each one of us was shocked. And I remember the disciples, it's written in your Bible, the disciples said, is it I, Lord? But do you notice that I didn't say that? You know what I said? I said, is it I, Rabbi? Does that mean anything to you? It meant something to me because it meant that I still continued on with my image and my understanding of who Jesus was. He was the Messiah, the Son of God, who was coming to save the Jewish people from the Roman occupation. He was my fantastic friend. He was a leader. He was my teacher. He was the person I admired. I recognized him as such, but not as the Lord of my life. But I'd given my life to working with him. But it also says in the Bible, that's when Satan entered me. Well, quite honestly, it's a nice way of putting things. Be quite honestly, it was my decision. I chose that at that moment I needed to do something because in my vision, Jesus, his goal, my leader, his vision and his goal had been derailed. Somewhere he had shifted off course and I needed to put him back on course again. Me, Judas, had to put Jesus back on course again. You see, how are you going to do this revolution if you're dead? But I knew the Pharisees wanted him gone at all costs. And I didn't expect for a second that Jesus was going to die when I betrayed him. Honestly, I didn't. What I thought was going to happen was, if I betray Jesus to the Pharisees who want him, then he's going to have to defend himself. I'm forcing him to make a stand that he seems to be waffling on making on his own. But if I force him to make that decision, he'll have to defend himself. And he's not going to do it physically with force. He is going to be going to a court of law, and he is going to defend himself there. What a way to get the next step up in this revolution of setting his people free. That's what I was thinking. But then when I went to see the Pharisees, and I know you've also heard the story that I wasn't always good with the money. But I find it amazing that Jesus never took me aside and chastised me. I guess maybe he knew all of our flaws and seemed to be willing to work with the flaws that we had. But anyway, I went to the Pharisees. I was going to say, I've got a plan. This could work. And they said, we'll give you 30 pieces of silver. And I'm like, it's not such a bad idea. I always wanted to improve my lot in life a little bit, gain a little extra coin here, and accomplish getting the revolution back on track. That can't be that. And so I did. I agreed. And that night, when I betrayed Jesus, you have no idea how surprised I was by the way Jesus did not react. When we were in the garden there, yeah, somebody wanted to start a little fight and we were going to resist, or they were going to resist on Jesus' behalf, but he quelled that real quickly. There was going to be no fighting here, no defense of Jesus with military might. No. And when he got to the court He didn't put up an argument. He didn't put up any kind of fight at all. And within hours of me betraying him, I found out that he was condemned to die. My friend was condemned to die. And I realized I had made a huge mistake. What I thought I was going to be putting into action was not what was going to be taking place. No. You see, people think I betrayed him because I hated him or because I was full of Satan. Well, yeah, if you call making bad decisions, it was a form of it, but I made some bad choices. But he was my rabbi. He was the leader of the revolution the way I saw it. He was the future of Jerusalem, the Jewish people. And in that sense, he was the future for me. Why would I betray my future? Why? But when I realized what I had done, I couldn't live with myself. I couldn't. And you know what I did. I took my own life because of who I had betrayed. And so you know me as simply Judas, the betrayer, or the son of the devil, or something other black thing. And you're right. I am. But before I go away, I'd like to just raise a couple of points. At the risk of sounding like I am justifying my actions, because I'm not. I know what I've done. But I want to ask you something. How then do you see the fact that my actions actually put into motion the events that led up to Jesus' death and resurrection? And actually your salvation. Did something wonderful come out of something that terrible? How do I reconcile that for myself? The other question I have is, I'm wondering whether you and I have more in common than we'd like to admit. That's an uncomfortable question to ask, I know that. But think about it. Even in my story, I wasn't the only one who betrayed Jesus. How many of the disciples stayed back at Gethsemane to put up a fight for Jesus? They scattered. They were gone. None of them were there. Oh yeah, Peter came back. Yep, he stayed with him, betrayed him 3 times. So my question is it possible that we each in our own way actually betray Jesus or have betrayed Jesus somewhere? And that's part of the reason it makes it so uncomfortable to talk to someone like me, because you don't want to be associated with someone. Third question. I already told you that I put Jesus in a box. And I think if I look at human nature, when you meet someone for the first time, we create a little slot or a box for this, for Joe. And as we get to know Joe, the box grows a little bit bigger. But after a while, we think we know Joe. And if Joe does something that confirms the Joe we know, we put that information in that box. And if he does something that seems totally out of character, I don't know, we know what to do with that. You can't put it in that box because that changes the Joe I know. So maybe we throw it away, maybe we ignore it. So my question is, me, the one who lived with Jesus, who was given power and authority to work and minister alongside Jesus, I thought I knew the Jesus I was following. I was following the Messiah who is going to set my people free, set me free from Roman occupation. And so when he did these other things like talk about dying and leaving, it didn't fit my box. And I guess I have to say, I really didn't know the Jesus I was following. But my question is, you followed him for quite a while. Have you left room in your box to let it grow? To broaden the box? To maybe see a part of Jesus you've never seen before, that you don't think is there. But maybe there's need for that box to expand a little bit. Don't make the same mistake I did. And lastly, just so you know how badly I misunderstood this Messiah, this Jesus I was following, think about my last action. I took my own life. I have often said to myself, if I had had any real comprehension of who I was following, who this Jesus, the Son of God, was, if I had had any idea, would my action have been necessary, or would I have understood that in this Jesus, the Son of God, there lived enough grace for even me. I'm wishing you a blessed Easter. For me, it's a living hell. Thank you for inviting me.